pass it on. Okay. I just wanted to welcome all of you here today. My name is Senator Kelly Ayotte, and I'm very glad to have the opportunity today just to hold an important field hearing. I serve on the Budget Committee in the Senate, and one of the important topics that we've dealt with, not only on the Budget Committee, but another committee I serve on, the Homeland Security and Government Oversight Committees, is tax-related identity theft and fraudulent tax returns. So I'm going to call this hearing to order for my constituents that are here today. This will be part of the official Senate record. We're having this as a field hearing, but it will be part of the Budget Committee's official record. And so that's why you see me here with the gavel and in this setting. And also I've got some staff members here from Washington to the Budget Committee as well as my own staff. So I'm going to convene this hearing and call this hearing of the Budget Committee to order. And with that, I would like to begin by thanking, we have in the first panel two witnesses with us, Ms. Lori Weeks from Stratford, New Hampshire, and also Mr. John Walker, who is here today to testify. I'm very appreciative from New Hampshire as well. And I will begin this hearing by giving an opening statement, and then I'm going to turn to our witnesses to provide us with information and to give their opening statements. So I want to thank all of you for joining us today on this important field hearing of the Senate Budget Committee. I'd like to thank all the witnesses on both panels that you'll hear today for their time and for their willingness to participate in this important discussion. And we're here today to discuss a growing problem, not only in New Hampshire, but across the country, and that's tax-related identity theft. Tax-related identity theft is a very serious problem that's growing, unfortunately, at epidemic proportions. According to the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, about 2.4 million taxpayers' names or Social Security numbers were used to file fraudulent tax returns in 2013. And as when this data was looked at, and that's tenfold increase from 2010, and then we've seen further activity in 2014 and beyond. And with major data breaches occurring more frequently, we've heard about these data breaches in the private sector and also most recently with the Office of Personnel Management and millions of people's information who have gone through a federal background check whose information has been breached from the federal government. I'm concerned that we will see additional cases of tax fraud that impact even more taxpayers in the future. Filing a tax return should be easy, but for an increasing number of taxpayers, not just actually filing the return and doing what they need to do that, they find themselves victims of identity theft. It's too often the beginning of a frustrating and burdensome process that can take even months or years to resolve. These innocent taxpayers frequently find themselves in a confusing and frustrating maze of bureaucratic red tape. I've heard stories from my constituents, some of whom are here today and some of whom couldn't be here today, who have been caught up in this maze of frustration. Not only do taxpayers have to spend too often countless hours collecting and submitting the necessary paper documents to prove their identities, they're often given conflicting instructions and inconsistent messages from the IRS. Or worse, they've had a lot of difficulties reaching the IRS. Instead of focusing on regaining and safeguarding their personal identities, these tax fraud victims spend hours simply trying to prove who they are actually to the IRS. And that's wrong. The IRS, I'm very glad to have the commissioner here today, we must do more to address this issue and better assist taxpayers who are facing this problem. One of those taxpayers we have here today is Lori Weeks from Stratford, New Hampshire, and I want to thank Lori for her willingness to share her story today and for her courage. Lori has endured something that no mother should ever have to experience, and that's the loss of her daughter, Madison, in a tragic car accident. That heartbreaking loss was compounded, and Lori was re-victimized and her family when her husband learned that Maddie's identity had been stolen and used to file three fraudulent tax returns. But when Lori asked the IRS for copies of the fraudulent returns so that she could find out how much of her family's personal information was compromised, the IRS said it could not provide her with information or a copy of the fraudulent tax return, citing privacy concerns. Tax fraud victims shouldn't be left in the dark regarding the full extent of what personal information was stolen, and the least the IRS can do is to provide them with copies of the fraudulent returns so that they can understand how their information was manipulated and used fraudulently. On behalf of Lori and other New Hampshire families, and really it was Lori who brought this to our attention, and I want to thank her for that, I wrote to Commissioner Koskinen, who's here with us today and who will be testifying on the second panel this spring, and asked the IRS to change its policy and to provide victims of tax fraud with copies of fraudulent returns filed on behalf of a tax fraud victim. In response, the commissioner has agreed to establish a process which identity theft victims can obtain copies of fraudulent returns, and I look forward to hearing an update on where that policy change is today. I thank the commissioner for agreeing to change that policy, and I certainly urge the agency to get this process in place as soon as possible. I've also heard from several tax fraud victims in New Hampshire who continue to struggle to get their refunds from the IRS even after having proven their identities to the agency. One constituent from Bath told me that the IRS told him that he should receive a refund within 6 weeks of proving his identity. When 8 weeks passed without any progress, he called the IRS again to follow up. After waiting on hold for 45 minutes, this individual was told that processing his case would take up to 6 months. The IRS's mission is to provide America's taxpayers top quality service by helping them understand and meet their tax responsibilities and by applying the tax law with integrity and fairness to all. However, these examples demonstrate the IRS is falling short of fulfilling this mission. In her latest report to Congress, Nina Olson, the taxpayer advocate, notes that the IRS continues to view itself as an enforcement agency first and a service agency second. While the IRS is taking some important steps to reduce fraud that have been recently announced, and I appreciate those efforts and we want to hear about those efforts today, including enhanced collaboration with representatives of tax preparation and software firms and other tax industry partners, and a new policy to earlier match W-2 information received from employees and employers, it's clear that much more must be done to prevent fraud from occurring in the first place, to make sure that people aren't victims of identity theft, and to better help victims when fraud does occur. Congress can also play a very important role to the extent that legislative fixes are needed to reduce fraud. Earlier this year, I worked with Senators Johnson, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who's the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, and Mark Warner of Virginia to help introduce the Bipartisan Social Security Identity Defense Act of 2015. This proposed legislation would require the IRS to notify an individual if it has reason to believe that someone's Social Security number has been fraudulently used, so notifying victims, incredibly important. It also requires the IRS notify law enforcement and that the Social Security Administration notify employers who submit fraudulently used Social Security numbers. this bill adds civil penalties and extends jail time for those who fraudulently use an individual's social security number. The purpose of our hearing today is to take a critical look at how the IRS handles tax-related identity theft cases with the goal of identifying necessary steps the IRS must take to improve its response to this growing problem. I want to welcome our first panel, Lori Weeks of Stratford and John Walker, a tax preparer based in Concord, who will share his experience working on tax-related identity theft cases for his clients. And during the second panel, we will, as I referenced earlier, hear from the IRS Commissioner, John Koskinen. We will also hear from the Inspector General, J. Russell George, from the Treasury Department. We appreciate the Inspector General being here today. And Mr. Christopher Lee of the National Taxpayer Advocate Service to examine the IRS's administrative practices and look at ways on how we can improve service to taxpayers and make sure that we're more responsive and take steps that need to be taken to prevent identity theft in the first place. Again, I want to thank all of you for being here today. And now I would like to call on our first witness. Again, I want to thank Lori Weeks for being here to offer her opening statement. Ms. Weeks.
Good afternoon. My name is Lori Weeks, or as I prefer to be referred to, Maddie's mom. This is my daughter, Madison Charlotte Weeks. Madison was born on June 23rd, 2006.
I had to move this up.
She was our first child. Through the years, Madison grew into a precocious little thing with a brilliant mind and an empathy for people that is rarely seen in a child her age. That empathy pushed her to continuously thank each and every veteran we passed on the street, to raise money for the fight against childhood cancer, and to volunteer for the March of Dimes, the organization that helped save her baby sister when she was born prematurely. Like I said before, Madison had a brilliant mind, and in second grade tested at the end of a fifth grade reading, writing, math, and science level. We were so proud, but not surprised. Madison was a talented dancer and was well-loved by every person she had ever met. Madison was a Girl Scout, an artist, an animal lover, a big sister, a best friend, my best friend. She had dreamed of opening a veterinarian's office when she grew up that offered free care to those who could not afford it. On February 19th, 2014, on our way to dance class, in the middle of her sixth year of dancing, I hit black ice, and we went off the road. We were okay, but in the blink of an eye, another motorist, distracted, did not see our vehicle and did not slow down. She hit our car and took the life of our precious daughter. Our lives are irreparably destroyed. In March of 2015, my husband and I prepared to file our taxes. As we walked in, I was having trouble breathing. Tears were already welling in my eyes. As we sat and reviewed our tax documents, I could not stop crying. This would be the last time, legally, on paper, that I could say that I am the mother of two daughters. I finished up this painful process, and later that day, my husband went to sign our documents. This is when we found out what we had left, that fleeting moment in time, had been stolen. Madison's identity had been stolen, and someone else had claimed her on their taxes. When your child goes on before you, all you have left is their memory and their identity, and you will tirelessly work to protect it. All I could hear in my head was that I had failed to protect Maddie's life, and now I have failed to protect her identity. Our tax preparer could offer little assistance. She was kind, but completely unaware of what our next step should be. We filed a police report with our local police department, only for them to treat us like we were crazy for doing so and telling us that it was unnecessary. I spent hours and hours on the phone trying to figure out what to do. Most of that was spent on hold. I spoke to multiple agencies and multiple representatives within each of those agencies, most of whom their calls led me back to another agent who just couldn't help me. Many encouraged me to file without Maddie on our return so that we could get our money. It was never about the money. I had to get Maddie's name back. It's all we have now. So we just kept searching for answers, searching for someone to help us. That is when a friend reached out to me and told me to contact Senator Ayotte's office. From there, the ball really got rolling. We were put in contact with the tax advocate's office, and they were able to see that Maddie's name had been filed at least 3 times, all of which had been rejected. Despite these attempts to fraudulently claim our child, we were never contacted by any IRS representative to make us aware that this had happened. With the help of Senator Ayotte's office and the tax advocate, we were able to go through the proper avenues to protect her name further, stop any kind of continuing fraud, usually using her Social Security number or otherwise, and we were able to file our taxes as a family of 4 for the very last time. We received our return, and then that was it. Nothing to tell us what these disturbed individuals who would raid a deceased child's identity knew about our daughter. Was it just her social? Did they know anything about her medical history? Do they have personal information about her death? Do we know them? It was quite literally, here's your check and be gone with you. After a newspaper article about our family and a few television interviews, we were told the IRS was going to be giving victims access to the fraudulent returns and the information contained within them. That was months ago, and we still are no closer to knowing what we must know than we were the day that we found out Maddie's identity had been stolen. More than 50% of grieving parents, parents whose children pass away before their 13th birthday, will have their child's identity stolen. And many will never even get as far as we have. We are not the rule, we are the exception. And it seems like the bad guys win in every case. Because although we got our daughter's name back, we do not know what they know about our daughter, and they will likely never face punishment for the crimes committed against our family. It's time that we step up and we empower our citizens to protect themselves and their children against these predators, and to say enough is enough. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I know all of our thoughts and prayers are with you, but for your courage of being willing to be at this hearing today to help other parents so that they don't have to go through this. I would like to also welcome Mr. John Walker, and I appreciate Mr. Walker being here to talk about his experience as a professional and working with many clients who unfortunately have dealt with identity theft issues and theft of their personal information. Mr. Walker, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for holding this hearing. My name is John Walker. I'm an enrolled agent in private practice, and I was asked to testify today from the perspective of an enrolled agent and its impact that the tax-related identity theft is having on the professional community. Now, just to clarify for those who are not familiar, when we talk about the professional community, I'm referring to the 4 groups of tax professionals that we generally talk about: enrolled agents, CPAs, attorneys, and then all other preparers. Generally, it is enrolled agents like myself, CPAs, and attorneys who are authorized under Circular 230, which are the Treasury regulations, to represent taxpayers before the Internal Revenue Service. Other preparers, with in a few very limited special exceptions, do not represent taxpayers. I represent taxpayers such as Lori and others who have problems dealing with the IRS, have these experiences, have jobs, family, responsibilities that they must move forward with, and they turn to someone like me or an attorney or a CPA to handle the dealing with the IRS, do the investigation, because we know the system. As a professional, I'm a member of the National Association of Enrolled Agents, the National Association of Tax Professionals, the National Society of Accountants, And I'm currently on the board of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Society of Accountants. On a monthly basis, I participate with members of the IRS and 15 to 30 other tax professionals from around New York and New England in what are called IMRS telephone conferences. IMRS is the IRS's own issue management resolution system. In addition, twice a year I participate in taxpayer liaison meetings, one of which we host here in New Hampshire, and that is two dozen tax professionals and IRS managers meeting for half a day to discuss in depth the issues in our tax system. So with that as a background, I can tell you the issue that I am hearing over and over and over again from other professionals is that as a result of tax-related identity theft and the escalation of fraudulent returns, tax professionals are increasingly finding themselves shut out of being able to get the information they need to help their clients, to help the victims of these identity thefts. It's regrettably, but in the haste to respond to the explosion of fraudulent returns, the IRS has severely restricted or blocked entirely access to taxpayer information by those three professional groups, enrolled agents, CPAs, and attorneys, who are responsible for representing those victims. As a representative, just like an attorney, we speak for the victim. We step into their shoes. We put in the time, the hours, to try to find solutions. This is happening even when a taxpayer has specifically authorized us on a federal power of attorney, which is an IRS document, to represent them in the identity theft matter. I recently have one that was filed in August and is continually rejected for being posted because their 2014 tax year has already been flagged as having had an identity theft. So, the general consensus of so many professionals right now is that we feel like the IRS, instead of working with the professional community to speed resolution of these cases, is making it increasingly difficult and sometimes impossible to help these clients. Furthermore, and this is terribly important from a professional point of view, the victims of identity theft are still expected to comply with all other aspects of the tax law. Timely file their returns, pay their taxes, make estimated tax payments, continue installment payments, and fulfill obligations that under an offer and compromise if they have one. Routinely problems, ordinary routine tax problems will arise in those other compliance issues. The estimated payments posted to the wrong account or the wrong year. Just to give you one example. To assist the taxpayer with any of those problems and do it quickly and efficiently and get it corrected requires that we continue to have access to the same information we had before the identity theft occurred. In a case I'm currently working now, the taxpayers came out of bankruptcy last year. As part of their bankruptcy plan, they're paying on past tax debt. I cannot get any records to find out if those payments are being correctly applied to their past tax debt. And that is something that we used to have routinely as a matter of being able to represent people. Normally, a representative would have online access to a client's tax information using a tool that's very different from that Get Transcript tool that was out there and became such a problem earlier this year. The professional tool works much more like what most of us use to manage our personal bank accounts, perhaps even our medical accounts, make our utility payments, credit card accounts, insurance, student records, and the like. In other words, access to it is known only to us. The what makes this all the more frustrating for tax professionals is that very often a representative or someone posing as a representative or someone claiming to be the taxpayer can call the customer service number. Granted, they have to sit on hold for anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, so it becomes an endurance contest. They get a customer service rep. They can answer a few simple questions, social security number, address, and so on, and the representative will mail, fax, or even read the information to them over the phone. So, from a professional standpoint, the information that we used to be able to get in 5 or 10 minutes online and get a problem solved, now we may be able to get if we're willing to sit for 2 hours on the phone and talk to someone. It's delaying the whole process, and that is creating a backlog of unsolved routine problems, in addition to and over and above and beyond the identity theft problems, which are exploding. One specific example that I, in suggestion I can make to the IRS, is that with the professional community, they ought to be doing exactly the opposite. They should be requiring professionals to get the information online, beef up the security around that tool, and that would relieve some of the burden on the phone system, which does have to be there to service taxpayers who are not represented. For example, recently I had to get a bank statement, a copy of a bank statement on my personal account. There were only two ways I could get it. I could not get it by calling the bank and saying, please mail it to me. I had to either show up at a branch office with a photo ID and prove who I was, and they would print it for me at that office. Or I could go online to my account where I have set up the security, 3 security questions and so on, and answer the various security protocols, submit a request, and it would be mailed to me to the address on record. I'd like to point out that enrolled agents, CPAs, and attorneys are all professional individuals who've made a substantial investment in both obtaining a professional license and in maintaining it on an annual basis. We are known to our various licensing agencies, and we have often been the subject, depending on the agency, of criminal background checks and even fingerprinting. In the case of enrolled agents, we've been vetted by the IRS itself. So if the IRS does not have confidence in letting us have access to the information, they're saying they don't have confidence in their own vetting process. Furthermore, we know our clients personally, usually for many years of working with the same client, sometimes decades. As a result, we also have access to a substantial amount of financial detail. This is a resource the IRS could be using to quickly identify who is the real John Walker, or Lori, or Bill, or Joe, or Susie, and they're not doing it. Instead, taxpayers are being told, once they file an identity theft affidavit, that it may take 6 months to a year before the IRS does its own investigation. That seems totally unnecessary. Furthermore, I think the delay is absurd because in far less time, you can get a passport. In 4 to 6 weeks, the State Department can determine with a high degree of certainty, even in this post 9/11 era, who somebody's identity is. And if they need to expedite it, they can do it in 2 or 3 weeks. In the case of tax-related identity theft, one very obvious and I think simple solution to establish who is the real individual would be to ask them to show up at a IRS office and present their passport. And if they don't have a passport, they can get one in less time than the IRS conducts those investigations. That the length of that investigation frustrates our clients terribly because they hear nothing for months. And they wonder if they're going to come back and say, well, we don't believe it's you. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, they don't know what else is going on with their financial lives. There are a number of further examples I can give you of the kinds of difficulties we run into dealing with the IRS. And I have a great deal of respect for everyone at the IRS I deal with. We are professionals. We understand they are dedicated people trying to do a very difficult job. The case, one case I'm currently working, provides some good examples. Chris and Jane Stevens, not their real names, are a couple in their early 60s. They got into financial difficulty because they tried to keep a business running in New Hampshire during the downturn in the economy. Got way overextended on their mortgages, ended up in a bankruptcy that dragged on for several years, finally came out of bankruptcy last August. Chris, by the way, was identified with inoperable but treatable throat cancer. So he was out of work. His wife continues to work. Jane continues to work. In February, they received a check in the mail from Sunrise Bank in California for $9,855. The accompanying paperwork explained that this was their 2014 federal tax refund, which was listed as $9,945, less $90 in processing fees. The letter explained that the bank had tried to direct deposit it to the account specified on the return, but for some reason was unable to do so, so they mailed them a paper check. The Stevens immediately knew this was wrong because we had not even begun to prepare their 2014 return. And they are very honest people. They also knew and were already worried about the fact that their identities had been stolen in the Anthem data breach just a few weeks earlier. So they contacted me, and we quickly prepared and filed the identity theft affidavits with the IRS. We have received one communication indicating that they have received the paperwork, and that was filed in February. Meanwhile, and this looked like we had caught it early, we should be able to solve this situation really easily because we had the check, the money was not stolen, it was not gone. I began investigating how the fraudulent refund, how the fraudulent funds could be returned to the Treasury. And apparently it's a lot easier to get money out of the Treasury than it is to get it back in. No one had any answers. So I reached out to one of my contacts, an IRS stakeholder liaison, which is a group that interacts extensively with the professional community, for help in answering that question. How do we get the money back in? It actually took her a little over a month to find a door to put the money back in. She got the name and address of an IRS office in Fresno, California, where we could send the check. So on April 15th, and maybe that was a bad omen, we mailed the check with a cover letter explaining the situation, included all possible identification. Incidentally, much of that was also printed on the check. We mailed it, priority mail, signature required. And within a few days, we received the name, signature, and ID number of the person who signed for it at the IRS office. We filed their 2014 tax return, which had a balance due, and thought we were pretty well done. Yep. One of the obvious problems in this whole story is this is somebody who already had a tax debt, they had a balance due on the 2014 return, and yet somehow somebody imitating them with their stolen ID was able to get $9,945 shipped out of the U.S. Treasury without ever checking the balance due on that ID number. The first week of August, the Stevens received a call from a revenue officer in Holtsville, New York. Because I was their representative, I returned the call to Holtsville, spoke with this revenue officer, and she wanted the Stevens to return the check. That's why she was calling. And I explained to her that we had mailed the check back in April and how we'd done it and how we got the address, where we had sent it, and so on. Well, she checked, no sign of it on the system. She didn't believe it had been returned, or if it had been, it had been lost. Her words. There was no record of it. So I said, well, look, and I convinced her to let me fax over the same package we had. The cover letter, copy of the check, all the identification information, the signature of the person who signed for it, postal transcript of every place it went between New Hampshire and California. I sent that fax within the hour. Never heard from her. 2 or 3 days later, I called. Her only response was that she hadn't received the fax. She hadn't bothered to call and say, I haven't received the fax, which is something normally one professional would do with another. I work with attorneys and CPAs all the time. If I say I'm going to fax something and I don't, or they say they're going to fax something to me, there's a follow-up call. Hey, I didn't get your fax. Didn't hear anything. The revenue officer instead shipped the case over to Exam with the comment that they could pursue the client for the money. And that was the extent of her involvement with it. Just a few days later, we received a letter from, this time from the Kansas City campus. So now we've got California, Holtsville, New York, and Kansas City involved. Kansas City is demanding, this letter demands that the Stevens either return the check or pay the $9,855. The letter was dated August 12. They have until September 3rd to do one or the other. We obviously can't return a check we've already returned and it's been lost by the IRS. So at that point, Jane Stevens and I, and it was necessary for both of us to get involved so the bank could be sure of this, got in touch with Sunrise Bank, their fraud department, and we were able to establish that the check, in fact, had never been cashed, which is fortunate. The also learned that the funds are still in the account at Sunrise Bank, and Sunrise Bank is only too happy to return them. The bank does actually have a process, because Sunrise Bank, which many professionals will recognize, is an outfit that processes tax refund third-party products for a lot of software companies. They actually have a process in place to get funds back to the Treasury. Jane authorized them to proceed with that. It will take at least 15 days to get that, but it does require first that they get cooperation from the IRS and an agreement that they will accept the return of the funds. Then we have the small issue of making sure they get credited to the Stevens account. In the meantime, however, the bank's fraud department can't provide us with any written confirmation to explain to Kansas City what actually is happening. That responsibility falls to me. I was about to end the conversation with the fraud department, the representatives said she had one other thing she had to point out to me. They are required, before they return the funds, to try again to deposit the funds in the bank account specified by the thief on the fraudulent return. I won't say anything about that, but the disturbing part in that, however, is that the IRS has the power to subpoena the bank records and see what's all they can from that account, see whatever they can learn about it. They also have the power to levy that account and seize those funds before they go back to the thief by chance. Because if they don't get them back, what they are going to do is turn around, and in the next few months, they will be sending my client notices that they're going to levy their accounts to get the money back. That's a fairly typical situation that as professionals, we have to deal with. And we're frustrated because we are professionals. We are willing to work with the IRS. We have a wealth of information about our clients. It's a resource that's not being put to good use. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Pretty shocking when you hear that's a typical story for what you've done just for these two clients. And I want to thank both of you for your testimony. And I just have a few follow-up questions, and then we'll get to the second panel. I wanted to ask you, Ms. Weeks, in terms of what you've been dealing with, how did you first learn that Maddie's Social Security number was actually used in a fraudulent return? And you, what happened to you when you did learn that and try to call the IRS?
We were basically kind of given the runaround by each office. I don't think it was necessarily intentional. I really think that everyone we spoke to had no idea where to go next, specifically because she was a minor and because she had passed away. People didn't know what our next steps should be. They were mostly thinking that we were concerned with our return and getting the money, but that was not our primary concern. We could have easily filed and gotten the return back and then gone through the process. I was told anywhere from 6 months to a year at that point to regain Madison's identity, but that was never an option for us. We were not going to let them, not the IRS, but the thieves, take from us the last chance we had on paper to say that Madison was our child, that we had two children in our family, in our hearts for the rest of our lives. We are a family of four, but this was our last chance to say on paper that we were a family of four. So when we called the offices and pretty much everyone said, well, why don't you just file and then we can go through, it was just a big runaround. It was impossible to prove that she was ours, but it was super easy for someone to take her away from us. That part didn't make sense to me. I had to provide not only my identifying information with a birth certificate, Social Security card, driver's license, but I also actually had to send over my daughter's death certificate to the IRS to prove that she had passed away, that as if I would call and state that my 7-year-old child was gone when she was not. I had to provide multiple copies of that information to multiple agencies.
Different people
yeah. Within the same agency.
Were never assigned one point of contact?
Never. The only time I was when I started working with your office, mm-hmm. and the tax advocate's office was assigned to me. Right. Other than that, I just kept getting pushed to one person, to the next person, to the next person. And online, there was very little help as well as even a resource to go that says, okay, this has happened to you, and these are the steps you need to take. It was all over the board, and no one website could give us concrete steps as to your child's identity has been stolen. This is what you need to do next. After this, you do this. Make sure you keep copies of this. Like I said, the police department made us feel like we were being kind of silly filing a police report with them. But then speaking with someone in the IRS office, they said, oh, if you hadn't gotten that, we couldn't have moved forward. But even the police department, our tax preparer, neither of them were 100% sure if we even needed to do that. But we wanted to cover all of our bases, so we did.
And I know that, as I understand it, you've heard from other families that have gone through this as well.
Many.
Unfortunately.
I am a part of several online support groups for grieving families. And when we started going through this, just like I do a lot, I shared on the website what we were going through. And very quickly. The page filled up with us two, us two, us two, us two. And if it wasn't their child, it was their sister's child's identity had been stolen. Multiple friends on Facebook and through personal conversations spoke to me about their family members going through very similar things. A friend of mine, her cousin, passed away several years ago when he was 19 years old, and his identity was stolen, and the IRS refused to correct the fraudulent return because the check had been mailed and the person who stole his identity had cashed it. And they told his parents, his grieving parents, that they couldn't prove that they weren't the ones that received the check and cashed it, so they refused to correct the situation. It's been 5 years and they are still fighting for their son's identity back. They don't, it's not about the money for them, just like it wasn't for us. It was about saying that this child is ours and somebody taking that from you.
Thanks. And Mr. Walker, you had referenced the history of having your professional history and dealing with this, how things have changed. When has this changed? You used to be able to get better access for your clients to be able to help manage their day-to-day tax issues, but also resolve issues. So can you give us some perspective?
Yes, in the last 18 to 24 months is when we started seeing this freeze come on. When you work a client's issue for multiple years, as I do, you're constantly going back to make sure payments have been made and applied to the right year, and so on. So you need that access to see those records.
And how has been the response time as a practitioner, as someone who's a professional? Is you talked about an hour to two trying to get through. Is that been your historical experience, or do you think that we're facing it?
The phone service has always been time-consuming. There are certain times of the day, if you time it carefully, you can get through faster than others, and as a professional, you learn when those times are. But one of the problems, of course, with the phone service is that the call gets routed anywhere all over the country. You're never talking to the same individual. And so you don't get the same answer. In fact, you can call as a professional, for example, trying to settle a payment plan, and they'll tell you they want the information on a 433A. You call back when you've got that financial information on a 433A. That person says, oh, I only work with 433F. And on it goes. I have one client who owed money. He made 7 calls to try to pay the balance due and find out what he had to do. He got a different story from every collection person. He came to me. It took me 5 calls. This was somebody who wanted to full pay his tax debt in 4 years. And it was an argument over whether his financial information was going to be on an A, a B, a F, or one or the other. There are 5 different 433s.
And how do you think we could resolve that? It sounds like getting back to allow professionals to have tools they've had in the past to communicate on behalf of their clients, and also more consistency in terms of who you're dealing with when you call as opposed to being bounced around?
Yes. There should be, when you're working these cases, it would make sense to have one point of contact.
Assigned to you. Yeah.
It would speed things up. If we had access to the online tools, the thing is, we have the knowledge and the experience to read those transcripts, to know what's going on, to do the investigation, so that when we call, we're not saying, hey, we've got this problem. We're calling saying the estimated tax payments for 2013 were applied to 2008 and they shouldn't have been. That's supposed to be these payments. We call the solutions.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be here today to testify before this committee. It's very important to hear the perspective of what are the difficulties that taxpayers are facing. And I know that there are many other of my constituents who are here who have written me or are here today who have experienced, unfortunately, similar situations where they feel that they've gotten the runaround. And And so I want to thank both of you for being here, and I'm going to call the second panel up. And I'm glad that our second panel certainly have been able to be present and hear directly your experiences, because they're in a position where hopefully they can address these concerns. So thank you both very much for spending the time here.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.